Wow. Good evening, everyone. My name is Ken Hinge. I'm an alcoholic. Very grateful to be here. It's an honor to be able to share some of my experience, strength, and hope. And I'm truly grateful for this opportunity. I want to thank the 1600 Club for being here for me when I need a meeting to go to. I also want to take a moment to thank Matt for inviting me. I probably should also apologize to the whole group. You were supposed to have Darren. You got me. But grateful to be here, and happy Sunday, everybody. Alcohol, and I should go ahead and say drugs because I use a lot of those non-AA approved chemicals, pretty much influenced my entire life for over 28 years. It influenced every decision I made, every result from those decisions. It influenced the jobs I had or didn't have. It influenced my relationships, and it nearly killed me. And towards the end of that 28 years, I spent many years homeless, pushing a grocery cart, living under a bridge, just absolutely no clue how to stop the madness. And I'm a product of six DUIs, lots of jail tours, and six different treatment centers. And I couldn't get sober. And I've been court sent to AA, didn't find it necessary to participate, just got my court card signed and went about my business. I did a tour in jail, and they put me in this kind of a treatment center setting where they had psychologists that come in and tell us how sick we are. And I spent some time doing all that. But I got, at that moment, the interest in how to stop the madness. And then I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous willingly. And I participated in the fellowship. I got some commitments and got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous as far as fellowship. What I didn't realize at the time is that y'all couldn't keep me sober. Human power doesn't work for me. And though I enjoyed the fellowship and I enjoyed being part of it, and I really enjoyed being able to share, though I really didn't have anything to share in those days, but I babbled nonsense and you guys put up with it, and so it made me feel good. The reality of it is that I continued to drink, and I continued to drink. And in November of 1994, I found myself in Los Angeles dying from alcoholism, living in the abandoned houses and apartments and so forth that were available after the Northridge earthquake. And it was wonderful because all the abandoned homes had alcohol in them, and I just rummaged through there and drink myself to death. And of course, every once in a while, I would change clothes if the person that lived in the house had clothes that fit me. And some more tours in L.A. County Jail because I didn't realize it at the time, but they call that trespassing. And, what's interesting is, and like I said, I've done many tours in jail. And, of course, the first thing I say to myself when I leave jail is, I'm never going to do this again. I'm never going back there again. And then I went back. And then I get released and say, I'm never going back there again. And then I'd go back. And, of course, the tours got longer and longer, and I got to the point where there wasn't any availability to work or earn, or there was no car. Everything was gone by the time I got released from jail. So I had to start all over again, and my keen intellectual alcoholic mind told me what it always told me. Go have a drink. You'll feel better. And I would take action on that insane idea, and I triggered the allergy, and I couldn't stop drinking. This went on for a while, and I found myself in this abandoned mansion where I finally said for the first time in my life, as I was laying on the floor and couldn't get up, dying from alcoholism, dying from drug addiction, and I said something that I had said countless times throughout my younger life, but never with the desperation I meant that night. I said, "Dear God, please help me." Now, I've always treated God like a servant. Get me this, get me that. I've always needed God when I went to jail. It's amazing how spiritual we get when the jailhouse door slams shut. I always used God to get me the job and get me the house, and by the way, get me the girl. There was always, using God like a servant. But this night, I didn't use God as a servant to get me what I thought I needed. I really desperately did not know how to recover, how to get past the mess I was in, and I didn't want to die. Now, I figured that God was going to, you know, send me someplace really nice and fancy, maybe Betty Ford with the red carpet and some spas and things like that. But that didn't happen. Through a series of events, I got finally made it to Acton Rehab up in Palmdale. This is a L.A. County-run facility. There were 300 beds, and most people there, it's a 90-day program. Most people there were just interested in having a place to stay for 90 days and get back on with their life. But I didn't go there for that reason. I went there purposely to try to see if I could understand what's going on with me and see if I can figure out how to fix it. Because I had no clue, and I've been trying for years to stop drinking, and I could not stop. And every once in a while when I went to jail, I was able to stop. But then I'd get released from jail, 3 o'clock in the morning, and my head would say the same thing all the time. Go have a drink, you'll feel better. And I would take action on that. And so, you know, I'm in a position where I couldn't stop once I started, and I couldn't keep from starting. And I was an absolute mess. And I went to this treatment center up at Palmdale, a place called Acton Rehab. And the man who eventually became a very close friend of mine, a member from Alcoholics Anonymous, came up to this facility 4 nights a week to anyone who wanted to have understanding of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I had read this book countless times. Every time I went to jail, I read it. You know? And I never got anything out of it. I thought it was a bunch of junk. And then, of course, I'd go through all kinds of trouble again. I'd go back into jail again. I'd read it again, and I'd come up with the same conclusion. What I didn't realize is that I was trying to read the book with the mind that was causing all my problems. And Albert Einstein told us that you cannot solve a problem at the same level of thinking that's creating the problem. So there was no way that I was going to be able to understand the book Alcoholics Anonymous and be able to take the actions that it's asking based on my own ability to read. And, you know, I've got school behind me. I understand how to read. I can comprehend the English language. But by God, I did not figure out what Bill Wilson was trying to tell us in the first portion of our book until I got to Acton Rehab. And there was this guy there that we became real close. He came up 4 nights a week, and he asked me if I wanted to come and join the book study. And I looked at him, and I said, well, I've read this book a bunch of times. What's it going to tell me now that it didn't tell me before? And he looked at me and he says, well, we're not going to read the book. And I thought, what are we going to do? If you're not going to read it, I mean, it's not an entertaining book. It's boring as hell, actually. And besides that, there's no pictures in the book. There's nothing entertaining. What are we going to do that I don't already know? He says, we're not going to read it. We're going to study it. And I went, oh, one of these kind of guys. But I had a desire to get clean and sober. And so I went ahead and went to these book studies. I had nothing else to do. I'm in treatment, for goodness sakes. You know, it was interesting. For those who don't realize it, our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is still today the number one successful treatment for drug addiction and alcoholism, still today, that the world has ever seen. The most successful treatment program that the world has ever seen, still today. And out of 300 people in this facility, and this was an option, it wasn't mandatory, less than 20 people showed up to this book study to study the number one successful treatment for drug addiction and alcoholism. Can you imagine that? And of course, I was one of the 20, so I'm grateful for that opportunity. And when I got there, being so confused as to what was going on with me, because I had no clue, I really only had two questions when I got there. Number one, why is it I can't drink like I used to? I enjoyed drinking. If alcohol never did anything to me, I'd still be drinking today. I love the effect from alcohol. Why is it that I can't stop when I want to? And more importantly, you know, how come I can't stay stopped? And I had no answers to those questions. And mind you, by the time I was in this treatment center, I'd been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for 3 years and never heard of that answer until I got into the book. And this gentleman that was helping us understand the book, for the first time in my life, I got the opportunity to truly understand what Dr. Silkworth is trying to teach us in the doctor's opinion. to be able to understand what's going on mentally and what's going on physically. To be able to see how powerless I am over those two things. And for the first time, I began to understand why it is I can't drink like I used to. And how come I can't stop now that I want to. Now, knowing the problem doesn't solve the problem. So the truth of it is that as I got involved in the doctor's opinion and began to understand the mental obsession coupled with the physical craving, when I began to understand those two things, my first response to the gentleman that was providing the book study was, what the hell are we going to do about this? This is scary. This is telling me I'm guaranteed to relapse. And I didn't come to treatment to relapse. I came to treatment to get sober. What's this all about? And he looks at me kind of funny-like, and he says, well, we're going to go to the next chapter. And I said, no, I need some profound answer as to what I'm going to do about this here. No, we're going to the next chapter. Now, as I said, I have a desire to get sober, so I went ahead and followed his direction, and we got into the next chapter. And of course, the next chapter is Bill's story. And what I found most interesting in Bill's story, as we try to relate to Bill, was what he discovered in the very beginning of chapter one. You know, he's in war, it's World War I, he's got the uniform on, he's getting love, applause, war, moments sublime, intervals hilarious, got all this wonderful stuff going on. And he says, in the midst of that, I discovered liquor. Doesn't say he took a drink. It says he discovered something. Joe asks me, he says, what did you discover? And I got to thinking about that, and I began to realize, this is long before I became alcoholic, that I discovered from the alcohol is what sent me on years and years path of becoming alcoholic. That discovery. I did not come from a family of alcoholics, my pretty normal family as I grew up. Mom and Dad never separated, so I had a healthy home to grow up in. Quite frankly, there was really no reason to become alcoholic as far as my upbringing. And Mom and Dad would have these social gatherings where these social drinkers would be sipping on their alcohol. I was like, we call that alcohol abuse, by the way. They'd be sipping away, and these people would get up and go home and leave booze in their glasses. The craziest thing I've ever seen. And of course, I would, as a kid, would go help myself to it. So I drank alcohol long before I discovered what it could do for me. So there was really nothing new of taking a drink until I entered junior high school. And in junior high school, there was a lot of stuff going on with inside of me that I didn't know anything about. There was all kinds of emotions kicking off. There was a lot of anxieties because now I'm involved in what I consider junior high school as being an adult, right? And so I got to deal with all the other peers and other students I'm going to school with. I had to be cool. You know, that's a major job to be cool. And that was difficult. There was obviously the embarrassment of not being a C or a B student, you know. I didn't say A, right, because I was never going to get there. But, but you know, there was all that competition going on. I wanted to play sports. I wasn't any good at it. So there was that kind of stuff going on. And probably the biggest thing of all was I started getting interested in you girls. Oh, my Lord. Did that change everything? Oh, yeah. And all the, you know, how do you deal with this? How do you talk to them? You know, and all the desires and the wants that I had. It was all this stuff going on. And then I get invited to my first junior high school dance. And, of course, you know that white boys can't dance. So here I come into this gymnasium, and I walked through the double doors, and it hit me like a block wall. All that fear. Oh, my God, there they are. And all the fellas must have been going through the same thing because they're up against this wall over here, and the gals were doing the same. They're over here and this wall over here. It got this huge basketball court in the middle. We weren't never going to get together. And, of course, with all the fear and anxieties and all the stuff that's going on with me, I plastered myself against the wall, but like everybody else. No way I'm getting out in the middle of a basketball court making a fool out of myself. Everybody looking at me, I don't think so. And a friend of mine took me back in the bathroom. He says, I stole some whiskey from my father. Let's go back in the bathroom. Now, remember, I've already mentioned that I've drank many times before this experience, but I never discovered what liquor could do for me until I got in that bathroom. And we plowed down a little bit of whiskey, and all of a sudden, I had arrived. The magic happened. Oh, man, I come out of that bathroom. Boy, it was on. Ready to go out and dance now, see? And I got out on that dance floor. I didn't care what anybody thought, you know. Got my finger up in the air. It was quite an experience. My mind recorded that. And I knew that that was the magic elixir that was going to fix all my emotional problems. It was going to take care of everything. I never looked at it that way before until I read the first paragraph in Bill's story where he says, I discovered liquor. And that discovery is what Dr. Silkworth calls that sense of ease and comfort. It comes at once by taking a drink. And oh my God, talk about ease and comfort. I got real good looking. Must have got rich because it started blowing money left and right, you know? Alcohol got me not only to get out on the dance floor, but allowed me to get out in the parking lot eventually and got to do some things out there I always wanted to do too. Can we relate? The reality of it is that once I experienced that, once I discovered that effect, my mind recorded it, and from that time on, my mind wanted to get that relief one more time. And slowly I started drinking a little bit more, and slowly I started getting into parties, you know. And then now I'm in high school, and I'm starting to take booze with me to football games, and I'm going to parties where everybody's drinking, because if you ain't drinking, I ain't coming. Before I knew it, I started associating with only people that drank. I didn't know the people that didn't drink. We called them squares. There was no association with any normal people. The abnormal become normal to me, being associated with everybody that was doing exactly the same thing that I was doing. You know, Dr. Silkworth says to us that we cannot create that allergic reaction, which is a physical craving. That cannot happen unless we become chronic, which means drinking continuously. And I always wondered, you know, because I fall victim to that conversation that occurs in AA about, is it hereditary? Are we born with it? Is there a gene? Is there some kind of, you know, element within us that, you know, the apple don't fall far from the tree kind of thing? But there was none of that in my household anyways as I grew up. So, you know, I really didn't understand how in the world I could become alcoholic. And then I began to understand that it's the chronic drinking. Why was I drinking all the time? Because I wanted that effect all the time. And I just absolutely loved what it did for me. Like I said earlier, if it never did anything to me, I'd still be drinking today. But as things got worse and I started drinking more, I got to the point where I started realizing that I'm probably drinking a little bit too much. So then I did that infamous experiment about controlling my drinking. And I was at the point now where I couldn't control my drinking while drinking. It just didn't work. I tried this experiment of buying a half pint, because nobody can get drunk on a half pint. Well, I'm sure everybody in this room knows how well that experiment worked. That was one of my many tours for DUI back in jail. The reality is that I really got in a position where I couldn't control it, and I couldn't keep from starting back up again. And it just got worse, and it got worse. When I started recognizing it, I did the willpower to kind of stop it, and then realized willpower didn't work anymore either. And then I finally got what I call the effort syndrome. I just gave up and just said, well, go ahead and drink. Bill talks about that in chapter one when he talks about alcohol became his master. And now, of course, I'm having problems with jobs. I'm having problems with relationships. I'm losing everything. I can't build a life. Can't keep the wife. There was all this stuff going on. I decided, you know what, my problem is where I'm living at. I was raised in Fresno, and I decided all my problems are in Fresno, so I started geographics, and, you know, all in an effort to try to get sober. Of course, what do? I moved to San Francisco, where my sister's at. My sister owns a bar, so where else would I be? You can see the insanity going on here. And the last thing that I remember happening to me when it came to the people I cared about was I went to Santa Cruz where my mom lived. And I decided I was going to move in with mom. Yeah, she's going to love to have me. After all I'm going to do for her, she's going to love me. You know. Well, that lasted for a few months until the police showed up and decided that mom is not a place to stay anymore. You know. And now I'm completely homeless. I just got out of Santa Cruz jail with no vehicle. They impounded it. I got no money. I got no job. I got no vehicle. You know, and now I'm completely on my own two feet. And at that time, I thought it was the worst thing that could ever happen to me. Because now there's nobody, no enablers left. No ladies that I can sleep on their couches or in their beds. There's no friends anymore. There's nothing going on. And the last straw, of course, was when Mom said, "You got to go." I know today was the best thing that ever happened to me because it finally made me put my own 2 feet on the ground and look at where the problem was at. I have an excellent BS filter that blames everybody and everything for all my problems. That it was their fault. And if they didn't do that, I wouldn't have done this. And my life was in absolute shambles. And I started realizing all this while I was in this treatment center. And when we got through Bill's story, I said, "Joe, this is telling me I'm going to drink again. I can't do this. I came here to not drink, and this book is promising me I'm going to relapse. I'm going back to AA, because at AA, they say don't drink or use no matter what. This book is saying you're going to drink or use no matter what." And it scared the heck out of me. And I said, "What are we going to do? This is crazy." He said, "We're going to chapter 2. "I don't want to go to chapter 2. Give me some profound instructions and let's move on. My life is at stake here." I said, "No, we're going to chapter 2. So I go to chapter 2, and of course, there is a solution, which by the way means one. And I had a whole mountain of solutions I had figured out. And, you know, I thought, okay, I'm curious to see what this one is. And then I get to that part where Bill finally thinks we can take it, where he says, "The answer is a spiritual experience." Oh, I don't think so. Oh, my God. I didn't come to treatment to find God. I came to treatment to get sober so you can miss me with all this God stuff here. And I was very resentful. You know, I borderline between agnostic and atheism and was proud of it. That's the worst part. And the reality of it is that I told the Joe, I said, "This isn't going to work. You can miss me with this God stuff here. You know, there's got to be some kind of clinical treatment that I can deal with because this spiritual nonsense is not for me. It's not powerful enough. It's mamby-pamby stuff. There's no way to prove that God exists. There's all this." I had every argument in the world that could possibly, you know, muster. And he looks at me and says, "Well, that's okay. No problem. Where's the profound information on how to get sober?" He says, "We go to the next chapter." No, I don't want to. Going to go to the next chapter. And the next chapter is chapter 3, more about alcoholism. And, you know, I like to call it more about the insanity. I like to call it more about relapse. I like to call it more about me. Because chapter 3, what it's really about is an entire chapter to show us what's going to happen to us without a spiritual experience. And I went, "Oh, okay. I don't know if I can get that. You know, I might be the guy to prove this thing don't work, but I'll give it a shot." I had no choice when it was put to me that way. And so we got busy, got into chapter 4. At that point, the man who becomes my sponsor came up and did a workshop at the treatment center. I asked him to be my sponsor, and to my amazement, he said yes. The things he said that weekend absolutely blew me out of the door. For the first time in my life, I saw the entire 12-step program in one weekend. I didn't work the program, but I had the opportunity to see how it works, what we have to do, and what we can receive by doing it. And I'd never been able to put that together, no matter how many times I read the book, no matter how many book studies I went to. Because, you know, you go to a book study and you read a page or two, you know, and then you leave, you forget everything that you did, and you come back the following week, and, you know, you forgot what you did before, but now we're going to get a couple of more pages, and then you know, I couldn't put it together until that weekend. So I asked him to be my sponsor, and lo and behold, he said yes. So we got busy. And bless his heart, he came all the way to the high desert and sat down with me once a week. We got through the doctor's opinion. We got through Bill's story in chapters 1, chapters 2, chapters 3, chapters 4. You know, and we did the chapter 5. We did the third step prayer. "God, you know, relieve me of the bondage of self." I mean, and I started getting pretty excited. I was on fire. And I knew for sure that, you know what, this has got to be the way to go. I'm going to keep going here. I can hardly wait to get this inventory done. And at 102 days sober, I graduated that facility and I got me one of them near certificates. Oh, I am somebody now. And I decided that, my sponsor says, you're going to come to Pasadena, put you in sober living. We're going to get through this thing. And I was on fire. I said, yeah, you bet. I'm going to do this. I'm going to get through this inventory. I'm going to share all my deep, dark secrets with a total stranger. I can hardly wait to do this. By the way, I'm going to start making amends, making amends for the stuff I got away with. I can hardly wait to do that, too. But I was on fire because, you see, I'm going to get through this thing because I'm going to become a sponsor. Oh, yeah, I'm going to fix everybody. There's a lot of sick people in AA. I'm going to fix everybody. I was on fire. And I graduated and I left that facility. And my sponsor puts me into this sober living in Pasadena. And all of a sudden, I started thinking, which is always a problem for me. And I began to realize, you know what? I got to get me a job. It ain't got to be a real good job, but I got to get a job. I got to make some money. Give me some money because I can't be living in sober living. I got to get a place to live. By the way, in order to get that job, because I'm in construction, I'm going to have to get a car. I can't be, running around bucket loads of tools on a bus. I got to get, I had justification, rationals. Yeah, I got to get me a car. It doesn't have to be a real good car, but I got to get me a car, I got to get a car. I got to get a job. I got to get a house. Come to think of it, I was getting a little bit lonely, too. Amazing how lonely we get in treatment, you know what I mean? Yeah, so there might be some understanding woman that can help me out with that loneliness. And now all of a sudden my thoughts are about getting the house, the car, the girl, and the job. Which, by the way, is not a new plan for me. That's the same old wore-out plan I always put together that never worked before. That doesn't mean I didn't achieve these things. I just couldn't hang on to them. And here I'm going with that same plan again. And, when a real alcoholic refuses to engage in the number one statistically proven treatment program, which is our 12-step program, when an alcoholic refuses to do those things, well, you and I will substitute it. And I substituted the number one recovery program for alcoholism. I substituted it by attending meetings. And I went back to these meetings and I started attending me a lot of these here meetings. And I got me some morning meetings and some noon meetings and some night meetings. And then some loving member of Alcoholics Anonymous came up to me and says, you need to get a commitment. And so I got me some commitments. I got me a secretary commitment, see, because I was going to fix AA because it's broken. See, I'm going to fix it. So I'm going to run things. I'm also going to get me a chip commitment so I can hug you girls as you come up and get your chips. I also got me a treasury commitment. Of course, I ended up smoking that treasury up and had to make amends later on, but that's another story. But the reality of it is I got these commitments and I started sharing like I knew what I was talking about. I hadn't done inventory yet, right? Because I substituted the 12-step work by attending meetings. And the book goes up on the shelf and I started being, they told me meetings make or make it. And so I started making a lot of meetings. They said, don't need important miracles. So I'm sitting around holding on my ass in both hands and I'm waiting for that miracle. It was all this stuff going on. I fell victim to the slogans, take it slow, take it easy, one day at a time, just for today. And the worst one of all, don't drink or use no matter what. When we tell our new people, don't drink or use no matter what, whose power you think they're going to use to make that happen? As if they hadn't done it already. Yeah. And now I've completely blocked them from step one, which says powerless, by implying you got to use your own power to get sober. And we completely block our new people with that kind of stuff. And I realized that, I needed to get me some stuff, and there was all this stuff happening, and at 9.5 months of what I call stark raving sober, the most painful experience I've ever had. It was ugly. It was uncomfortable. I was angry. I was resentful, mad at everybody, and just couldn't figure out why I felt so terrible inside. No matter what I did, I got the job. I got the car. I got the house. I got the relationship. Got all that stuff in 9.5 months. Sobriety will allow us to pick up where we left off and get our ducks back in a row. But I needed a little bit more than sobriety because I don't like sobriety. It's painful. It hurts. And I can't stand it. Still today. And at 9.5 months of stark raving sober, my keen intellectual alcoholic mind told me what it always told me. Go have a drink. You'll feel better. I took action on that insane idea and I triggered the allergy and I couldn't stop drinking. And this, of course, set me on a run for about a year. And within this year, within 30 days, I was homeless, helpless, penniless, powerless, back in the bushes in Los Angeles, dying from alcoholism. It was an absolute nightmare. I ended up in a little town in Los Angeles called El Monte. Okay. Some of you know El Monte. Okay. Yeah. And not a good place to be for a sucked up white boy, I can tell you that. The reality of it is that by the grace of the El Monte Fire Department, I was in such terrible shape. They picked me up off their front lawn and told me I can't do that here, and placed my hands on a beautiful little grocery cart I had. It was a real nice grocery cart, only a little bit of rust. The wheels all ran true. It was, you know. And they gave me a shove to a treatment center, which turned out to be my last treatment center as a resident. And give you an idea of the condition I was in, I just blew right past that treatment center. And when I went past it, there was a little mom-and-pop store right down the road from there. And I pulled my cart up into the parking lot, and the clerk standing out there smoking a cigarette. And he takes one look at me, and he says, "It's over there." So I make a U-turn with my little grocery cart and ever so carefully parallel park up there in front of that facility. And then I walk up into the administration, keeping a close eye on my cart, because I don't want to steal my stuff. See, I got stuff in that cart, and I won't be stealing my stuff. And a brand new roll of carpet in there. The truth of the matter is that these people loved me so much, they not only let me in, which they should have probably sent me to the hospital, but they not only let me in, but they drug my cart in with me, because they knew I was going to stick around if I wasn't okay. And by the way, all these staff members were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They'd had a spiritual awakening, and they realized I needed help, and that the hospital would not be a good place to send me because I'd probably leave. And they were real 12-steppers, so they understood how important my stuff was. Otherwise, I'd have never gotten detoxed, were it not for the love and care that these people provided me. And I came out of that detox ward, and I made the absolute commitment that I'm not leaving. I'm not leaving till I have me one of them there spiritual awakenings. I don't know if it's going to work. I don't have a clue what a spiritual awakening is. The only thing I knew is that I can't live my life like this anymore. I didn't want to die, and I was headed for death, and I knew it. And so I got busy. And I told you I was on that run for a year. I called up the man that was sponsoring me after a year of running out there. And lo and behold, he shows up. You see, my sponsor is a real 12-step person, fundamentalist. If it's not in the book, he doesn't abide by it. So there was nothing about hiring and firing and all that stuff we hear today. When I was ready, in between the intervals, he shows up. And we got busy. We got busy with this program of ours that I am so grateful for. I still today don't want to do it. But I love the results, so I continue to do it. And we got involved in steps 1, 2, and 3 again. We got on our knees, held hands. You know, God, relieve me of the bondage of self. Hallelujah, I want to recover. And bang, I was in inventory. And I got involved in inventory. I wasn't going to skip a beat. I'm going to do this formula. I had no idea what this formula is about. All I knew is what I heard in meetings about dirty, filthy, nasty things and all this kind of stuff. But I was dying, and I knew it, and so I went ahead and followed the directions outlined in our book. And I began to realize that the whole purpose of the inventory is to discover the manifestations of self. Because the root of all our troubles is selfish and self-centeredness. I thought it was alcohol. And by the time I got to that point, I began to realize, no, the problem is not alcohol, that's but a symptom. The problem is selfish and self-centeredness. And I remember looking back at my life when I was living at home with mom and dad, and they always told me I was selfish. And I never paid a single attention to that. I said, yeah, you don't know what you're talking about. I don't even understand what you're talking about. It don't even matter. I never realized how much time I dedicated to thinking about me. I mean, I ain't much, but it's all I ever thought about. And the truth of the matter is I got involved in this inventory process to discover the common manifestations of self. Of course, Big Book Bill Wilson talks to us about resentments, fears, the harms I've done other people, especially through my sexual conduct. And I began to take a look at these things for the first time in my life. And what was absolutely amazing to me, I already had a pretty good idea that I was selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. And of course, the sexual inventory throws in inconsiderate. So I was already pretty sure of those kind of things. What I didn't know is what causes it. And if we don't begin to take a look at what causes it, you can't do anything about it. It's one thing to know the problem, but the problem can't solve the problem. You got to know what causes the problem. If my problem is selfish and self-centeredness, if my problem is is selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate behavior, then I have to take a look at what causes it, because I can't fix it if I don't. Now, Bill Wilson doesn't say much about that in the big book. All he says is that in most cases, it was because of our self-esteem, our personal relationships, including sex. He's talking about the instincts. He says, which one was interfered with? That's really all he says in the book. I'm not sure why he didn't give us more information in the big book. Perhaps he didn't know himself. But years later, when Bill writes the 12 and 12, in step four of the 12 and 12, he finally takes the time to explain it to Alcoholics Anonymous about the three basic instincts of life. Because those three basic instincts of life are given to every living thing on this planet. Every living thing on this planet. A blade of grass, a dog, a bear, a cow, and us human beings. We have the same three basic instincts of life. It's what allows that species to continue to regenerate themselves generation after generation. It's what allows that species to stay on the planet. It's what allows us human beings to live our lives successfully. But when those instincts start to become a little bit damaged, Bill says in the big book, hurt, threaten, sore, or burn. I began to understand it in step four of the 12 and 12, where he begins to say to us, these instincts, when they're out of whack, really get to confusing us. Because I get to the point where I can't distinguish the difference between what I need and what I want. And the minute I start focusing on what I want, selfish and self-centeredness jumps up and says, I got this. And then I'm on that path again. And I know that as long as I stay in that realm, that selfishness and that self-centeredness, even though my motives are good, even though I think I'm doing everything right, the uncomfortability, well, as Dr. Silkworth says, restless, irritable, and discontent, and the insanity returns, and we drink and we use again. And so the truth of the matter is, I got to take a look at these instincts. Bell says when these instincts become defected, they dominate us and they insist upon ruling our lives. I always thought it was my brain that made these decisions. As I got into the inventory process, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, as I got into that, I began to realize the brain is not, it's just a delegator. The decision maker is in our soul. It is those instincts. And when those instincts become defected, they begin to create emotional pain. And I found relief from that emotional pain when I was in junior high school back in the bathroom by taking a drink of whiskey. And from that time on, I was going to fix that emotional pain through a chemical. But what happens to us when we get to the point where the alcohol no longer does it for us and begins to do it tremendously to us? Now we're confronted with the absolute need to stop. And it was at that point that I began to get real scared, because how am I going to live life sober? I don't even like sobriety. Now, the inventory showed me what's causing all that, and as I got through the inventory process, shared it with another human being, and got into the amends process, because step nine is the step that fixes these things, I began to feel the relief. And what I began to realize is that now I'm fixing these emotional problems spiritually instead of chemically. The beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, as long as we don't just try to stay sober, if we get involved in recovery, is that the spirit is going to replace the chemical. I tried to stay sober and couldn't, because I removed that the chemical did for me and never replaced it with anything else. What I know today as the result of a spiritual awakening is that the 12-step program, the recovery process, not sobriety, pay close attention to how the book is written. Bill uses the word recovered constantly because he's trying to separate the difference. Yes, we have to get sober to start the psychological journey, but recovery is what we need to get to, because recovery is what replaced that the chemical did for me. Which is why I'm grateful for my life today. I'm enjoying my life today. I'm successful in my life today. Anybody want some of that? Are we not tired of being uncomfortable? There's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not talking about this room, I'm talking about AA as a whole, because I've been around for a long time. There's a lot of people that I run into in Alcoholics Anonymous who are very uncomfortable, who are not satisfied with what's going on in their lives, constantly in problems with relationships, having difficulties with their children. There's a lot of that going on in AA today. And when you hear them, they'll say, but I didn't drink today. Well, I don't know. If I was feeling all that there, I'd probably go ahead and drink. Because the truth of the matter is that the worst thing that can ever happen to an alcoholic is untreated alcoholism. if we can just get involved with somebody that understands our book and helps us go through this and begin to see the truth of what Bill Wilson and the First 100 are trying to tell us, to share with us, to direct us, so that we can be prepared to access 12 simple disciplines, which you won't agree with. The beautiful thing about program is I still don't agree with it today, but it's the result that keeps me in it. Don't think I love doing inventory. I do not. I don't like waking up in the morning and having to sit down and do prayer and meditation. I don't like to do my inventory because it always leads me to the amends process. And I don't like to make it to say I'm sorry for anything that I've done in the past. My sponsor says you can't say I'm sorry in the amends process. You have to say you're wrong. I still struggle with that today. But I will say this. One of the greatest disciplines of our 12-step program to keep me out of self is working with others. And I'm not talking about giving my phone numbers out, taking people to meetings, you know, holding hands and singing Kumbaya. I'm talking about sitting down, taking them through the book. It is the one time in my life, as often as I possibly can, that gets my mind to stop thinking about me. Because now I'm thinking about you. And therein lies the answer. For those who don't know the story of Bill Wilson when he goes to Akron, Bill Wilson, of course, is only 6 months sober. And as the result of a spiritual awakening, his sponsor, Eddie Thatcher, takes him through the tenets of the Oxford Group. He has an awakening, and now he goes to Akron to get a job. He goes to get a job. He was going to be the CEO of the Akron City Rubber Corporation. He's going to be a big shot. I can relate to that. And he gets in there to get this interview over with, and other people wanted this job. And next thing you know, there was an argument. There was a lot of character assassination, this proxy battle. Bill lost and did not get the job. And he leaves that Akron City Rubber Corporation and heads to his little hotel, the Mayflower Hotel, and he walks into the lobby feeling all kinds of sick, sad, and sorry for himself. Oh, my God, I got no money. I got no job. I got to go home and tell Lois I'm broke. And, you know, owe me, woe me, poe me, and poe me another drink. And he's standing in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, and there's a doorway over here with a big neon sign over it flashing, solution, solution, solution. It was a cocktail sign. And Bill says, I need to go in there and make a friend. And he goes in there to make a friend, right? Of course, he sits down at the bar, and he orders a drink, and the bartender literally sets the drink in front of him. At that moment, our lives as members of Alcoholics Anonymous was dangling from a thread. For had he taken that drink, we may not have Alcoholics Anonymous. But we do, because he didn't. Now I'm a real alcoholic, and if I go as far as sitting in a bar and ordering a drink, I'm drinking. He didn't. And I have been so amazed at what happened. Because he looked at that drink. Remember, he had a spiritual awakening in New York before he goes to Akron. And he looked at that drink. And at the moment he was getting ready to pick it up, he said to himself, if I take this drink, what about those other alcoholics? At that moment, he accessed grace. At that moment, he stopped thinking about himself and all his problems and started thinking about somebody other than himself. Through a series of events, he goes out to the payphone, starts dumping nickels in the payphone like he was in Vegas at a slot machine. And, you know, it took like 9 or 10 phone calls before he ever got a hold of Henrietta Cyberling, who, by the way, is the route that he took to finally meet Dr. Bob Smith. But what an amazing understanding to realize how important it is to work with others. It isn't about holding hands and giving phone numbers and sitting next to them in a meeting. It's about sitting somebody down that's dying from alcoholism and taking them through our book. It is an absolute amazing experience to have somebody's mother come running up to me crying, saying, thank you for giving my son back. I didn't have anything to do with that. I'm just a messenger. But I'm a crack smoker. Crack cocaine never gave me that feeling. The reality of it is that how wonderful is it to have little children coming running up to you and saying, thank you for bringing my daddy back. I don't want anybody to miss that experience. It's been an honor and a pleasure to be here tonight. God bless everybody. Thank you. Yeah.
All right, let's give Ken another round of applause.